From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
I'm here with my Brussels colleague, or my Brussels counterpart, I like to say, Jan Tekau, who's the director of Carnegie Europe. Jan is in town this week for the third annual Carnegie Global Dialogue at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Jan, it's a delight to have you back in Beijing this week. Thank you for joining the podcast, and thank you for joining the roundtable this morning.
No, thanks, Paul. It's a great, you know, pleasure to be here again after 1.5 years. High time for me to kind of, you know, get updated on what's cooking here and what you guys are doing and the damage you're doing over here.
Well, thank you also for joining the China and the World podcast. This is the first time we've had somebody from Carnegie Europe on the podcast, and it's nice to start with the director, the leader of the organization. And before we get into talking about China EU, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Carnegie Europe. When you came on board 4 years ago, you told me that you wanted to transform Carnegie Europe from a platform for dialogue and engagement to a real research center. It seems to me that you've done that, but I want to get your assessment on how things have developed over the 4 years that you've been there.
Yes, that was the mandate that I was given when I was hired in 2011. They said, you know, it's been a platform office now for 4 years or so, you know, meaning that it served the Carnegie community, you know, when they came to Europe so that they would find their counterparts and would have a platform to have events at. But they really wanted more out of the office. They wanted some real, you know, analysis, some commentary, you know, papers and all of the rest of the think tank stuff and real impact on the European side. And so I was the kind of lucky guy who got that mandate, you know, so you build a research center.
I mean, that's the guy at the right time.
Well, you know, I like to believe that myself. You know, often, you know, you sit there and think, oh, my God, you know, I hope all goes well.
But you've taken on this issue of strategic Europe as well as kind of the focus agenda item. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, when I came into the place and, you know, I needed to build that research approach, I said, okay, what I need here is some sort of label for it, some kind of umbrella topic that, you know, covers it and that people will associate with Carnegie mm-hmm. Europe after a while. Mm-hmm. And I chose strategic Europe because at the time, around that time, you know, the idea of global Europe, you know, was everywhere. Everybody talked about, you know, Europe should have, you know, a better, bigger foreign policy. It should be present around the globe, you know. And I was always very skeptical whether global Europe wasn't perhaps a bit too big in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, and too grandiose in terms of the language. For me, it was strategic Europe because strategy is all about choice. Mm-hmm. You know, you have limited resources, so you pick, you know, the stuff that's really relevant. Mm-hmm. That means that you need to prioritize. So you have all elements, you know, for strategy already kind of there. And so I call it strategic Europe. And we started using this very heavily. You know, we published under that label. We started a blog under that label. And it kind of caught on. And now it's associated with us. And when you punch it into Google, which I recommend all listeners to do, then you will find Carnegie Europe there.
Well, I'd recommend our listeners going there because there's some really great stuff. Let's talk about Europe. When you came last in the fall of 2014, you mentioned this morning during the roundtable when you were here last that there was tremendous stress then on the political system in Europe. And so before we look at China, I want to ask you about the European Union itself. For a long time, the EU has been the pioneer in experimenting with this idea of a supranational structure. Nationalism, however, has always been the sort of the specter haunting that European integration, Europe's ability to integrate. You wrote recently that nationalism, if used properly, could actually help integration. And I wanted to, although you say it will not be easy, but it could help integration. And I wanted to start by asking you what you meant by that, and if you could explain that a little bit.
I picked nationalism, and I wrote about this and tried to give it a positive twist. I think nationalism is in our kind of Western policy debates, you know, almost entirely negatively connotated.
Yeah.
People have nothing positive to say about it. But research, you know, and I have to bore people with a little bit of research here, when you actually look at what Benedict Anderson wrote, a guy who just died last year, a big political scientist, a Brit, who wrote the standard book about nationalism, mm-hmm. Called Invented Communities. He talked about this phenomenon of how nationalism is actually capable of creating solidarity among people that don't know each other. Before nationalism, before the nation, loyalty and solidarity was exercised at the family and clan level. It didn't go beyond this. Mm-hmm. Nationalism already all of a sudden provided a framework in which you could feel associated to somebody else from your same nation whom you had never seen, whom you would never see, and whom you had nothing sure. really in mm-hmm. common with apart from the fact that he was also part of your nation. Mm-hmm. So it expanded the scope of solidarity. It didn't shrink it. That's how we.
It turned it out.
Yeah, it turned it into a bigger entity in which you could think about, you know, he was one of me, of us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the forgotten element of nationalism, that it originally, in its original kind of, you know, purpose and function, it was able to expand mm-hmm. the horizon of solidarity and belonging. And this is why it's still such a powerful, you know, phenomenon
at
work.
And is your argument then extrapolating from there that you could move from the nation state to the European Union and bring that nationalism to that extent?
No, that's not my argument. Okay. I don't think that the supranational structure of the EU can ever replace the identity-creating mm-hmm. force of the nation. Mm-hmm. I don't think we will be able to move that, you know, mm-hmm. at least not, you know, within a time frame that's relevant for us here.
So is there an example then that would show how nationalism helps as opposed to hinders integration, the kind of integration that the EU is looking for?
I think the key is to understand that nationalism does what I've just explained. Mm-hmm. Because if you accept that this is the case, then your nationalism is just as good as that, you know, that other guy's sure. nationalism. If mm-hmm. if you realize that what it does for you, that you feel and identify with compatriots, quite literally, you know, people that are total strangers, and yet you feel that this also works for the other, then all of a sudden your own nationalism becomes, you know, relativated and mm-hmm. you can turn it into a positive force. And it's also, you know, I'm making this argument as a warning. I don't think that the EU or the European Union as such or the supranationalist project should aspire to replace the identity that is created by the nation. Mm-hmm. That would be a futile attempt. In the past, it was all about overcoming old identities. We need to kind of lift this to a higher level. I think that's nonsense. I think what's important is to understand the power of this, to acknowledge it, not to replace it, you know, but use its basic idea of expanding, mm-hmm. you know, the area or the circle of solidarity. And if we can do this, and if we can add to the nationalism that people have, the natural kind of affiliation they feel with their mm-hmm. nation, if we add mm-hmm. to this another layer that doesn't replace the nation, but adds another layer of sophistication to this, I think that would be good. And it's possible because already our identities are layered. Mm-hmm. You know, you're coming from a town, but also from a state,
sure.
and then from a nation, and you're coming from a university, and you're rooting mm-hmm. for a football club, mm-hmm. and you're part of a family, and then another family. So you already have layered
right.
identities.
Right.
You know, it's perfectly fine, I think, to expand it a little more, add a layer without destroying your mm-hmm. national identity. And that should take a lot of fear that people have
yeah.
vis-a-vis that supranational project should
sure.
take it away.
Closely related to successful political integration, of course, of Europe is a more coordinated foreign policy. And this is something that you've looked at quite closely. How do you think the EU is balancing a more coordinated foreign policy with respect to the prerogatives of individual member countries? And are there examples maybe related to China or Asia where different interests among member states have caused divisions or prevented a more coordinated or coherent strategy?
Well, the Europeans don't balance it very well. EU foreign policy is the big unkept promise of the integration project. There is no such thing as a common, you know, foreign policy really in mm-hmm. the EU. It's a field that is still one that's, you know, dealt with by the member states between themselves. It has mm-hmm. not been communalized. It has not been delegated to Brussels. It's the member states that need to seek consensus, you know, on each of these cases, you know, again and again and again. The member states saw to it that they would retain the veto over the key decisions on foreign policy. So, you know, in the end, for the most part, the national approach, the splintered, fragmented approach to foreign policy is the one that prevails in Brussels.
And going forward, are you hopeful that things will move in that direction or less optimistic?
Well, I mean, it depends on whether you buy into the sheer necessity argument.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a friend of the sheer necessity argument, then you can make an overwhelmingly strong case why it's necessary and why it will come. because the pressure from the outside on, you know, coming together more is quite obvious. It's quite clear. You can make such a, you know, absolutely flawless, intellectually sound case for more cooperation. You know, none of the European nations is particularly large. None of them is particularly powerful. None of them is a real military power. Yeah. You know, the case for sticking together, you know, formulating common approaches and executing it, you know, together in a coordinated way is absolutely, you know, very strong. So necessity would dictate, yes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the logic of politics is not always the logic of necessity. Right. And, you know, identities, rivalries, you know, pride, issues like this play out, you know, very, you know, big. And if you don't have enough of an overlap of interest, you know, in a community of 28, you know, where you have to build that consensus between places like Finland and Portugal, between places from, you know, from Poland to Ireland, you know, very different geopolitically located places, it's very difficult. You know, my sense is that in the future, what we will see is a continuation of the current trend, which is that we will have a case-by-case foreign policy. On occasion, we will have enough factors together so that the 28 can congregate, but the default position will still be fragmentation and a very slow-paced answer. That's not good. Mm-hmm. That's going to harm Europe. But my feeling is that learning through pain is probably the only option here.
Well, you're here in China this week, so let's take a look at relations with China. You said today in the roundtable this morning, you started out by saying that relations are primarily driven by mercantilism. Trade, business, economic, commercial relations, but that relations increasingly now feature a geopolitical aspect or geopolitical side. Why is the geopolitical component of relations emerging now?
Because both the Chinese drive into that direction and the Europeans as well. The original force that pulls them towards each other is, again, economics. You know, this is a weaker world economy. Everybody's looking for new markets, for safe investments. You know, Europe is a huge market. China is, you know, still a very dynamic economic, you know, powerhouse. So it's quite natural that they kind of, you know, want to come together. So that brings them together, but it always has a spillover effect. Mm-hmm. In the European case, the geopolitical issue is that it creates a dilemma, this you know, attraction that China has, a strategic dilemma for them, because it could potentially put them somewhere square in the middle between the US and China. Mm. You know, if you somehow assume that, you know, somewhere down the road there's some big power rivalry looming in the Asia Pacific between the US and China, then where do the Europeans fall? Whom will they side with? With their classic transatlantic ally, who's their security guarantor, or, you know, with the new economic dynamism and the lure that's coming from China? You know, it will be a tremendous, you know, kind of, you know, a stressful situation where the Europeans have to make a judgment call. And I think they should mentally prepare for this. So this is how geopolitics comes in from that side. But there's also a Chinese component to this, and that is that, of course, China is massively investing into, you know, this One Belt, One Road initiative, which clearly has Europe as its endpoint. It's this, you know, old, you know, Silk Road idea connecting China to the European markets by, you know, going straight through Central Asia. And, you know, already there are massive investments of China in Central Asia. The Europeans are being courted by the Chinese. You know, they're trying to get influence over the Europeans, invest there. All of that
here
is playing out.
On the face of it, it's a mercantilistic approach, commercial approach, economics. But you also mentioned this morning you see geopolitical spillover.
Yes, I mean, that's quite clearly also it's about gaining influence over the Europeans so that, you know, they can remind some European governments that, you know, a certain voting behavior in the European Council might be, you know, in order when it comes to divisive decisions about, you know, China-related issues. But also because it's interesting for China to see, you know, at least a little bit of a wedge being driven between the Europeans and the Americans. You know, whatever weakens the dominance of, you know, America as the kind of big superpower, which is something that they have an enormous hiccup about over here in China, you know, whatever weakens that position, whatever, you know, makes the number of allies, true allies for America smaller, is a positive thing for the strategic Chinese calculation. And so they're trying it, and Europe is the obvious kind of target for this because they're the closest allies, you know, that the United States has.
In terms of driving a wedge, it was interesting this morning in the discussion of market economy status, whether or not, this is a critical year, obviously, for the decision by the EU, whether they'll grant it. One of the arguments that we heard from our Chinese panelists was that the EU was being held hostage by the U.S., who does not want the EU to grant market economy status. But you seem to be presenting an argument that was based on European interest, European interest only. Is this another example of where sort of driving a wedge between the U.S. and the EU, saying the EU is beholden to the U.S. and the EU should make its own decisions on these issues?
I think it's true that America, of course, tries to influence Europe in its decision. They have a certain kind of interest, you know, and they don't think that the EU should grant the status. But the EU decision will be, you know, an independent decision because they have overwhelmingly their own interests in mind. And even in that debate, you know, it's not quite clear where they want to go because you have two factions inside Europe, you know, one that is kind of more hawkish on China and doesn't want to grant for their own reasons, not for American reasons.
And then and what are those reasons?
Well, the reasons are that this status, the fact that China wants it and it's Europe's to give, is the last little bit of leverage that the Europeans really have over economic policy in China. They don't have too much leverage, you know, but this is the one thing that China really wants. And since the Europeans, have a problem with the fact that their market is open to Chinese investment, but the Chinese market is not open at equal measure for the Europeans, they feel that they have a rough deal.
This asymmetric aspect that François Godemont talked about this morning.
That it's not a fair partnership.
EU is open and China is not.
Is not. And that the Europeans, you know, can use the market economy status as one way to get a better deal from the Chinese, to open up the market. And since this is the last remaining real tool that they have, they shouldn't give it away easily. And they should really use it as a political tool. So that's the hawkish kind of argument.
But even given this argument, your prediction today was that EU will probably grant market economies.
My feeling is that, you know, the dovish side will prevail, that the Europeans will probably grant it.
And the dovish argument is?
The dovish argument is that you can't really, you know, anger the Chinese too much. You know, it's important to, you know, to play the reliable side. The legal obligation is there, which is actually doubtful, but they make the argument that it is. It would only, you know, lead the Chinese to retaliate and these arguments. And that's, you know, that's the classic counter-argument. Treat the Chinese well or otherwise they're going to punish you. My feeling is that this is a flawed argument because even though we've had plenty of disputes with them politically, the economic activity has never really been affected by it. I think the Chinese have a very, very, you know, clear cost-benefit analysis when it comes to investments and trade, and that can be completely separated from some of the hiccups about, you know, principles and values or Tibet or whatever. You know,
Do you think in the end that it will probably be passed? And what could change that?
My feeling is that, you know, overall the Europeans will not bring it about to play this the hawkish way. I don't think that, you know, these voices will prevail. The Germans have essentially already sided with the dovish side. So have a number of other players. It seems to be a pretty weighty coalition on this side.
Another issue in terms of the U.S. as a factor in the EU-China relationship is the recent launching of the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, which the U.S. and European countries took a very different approach. And some say this revealed differences, divisions between the U.S. and EU's approaches to China. Some have even said that the two bilateral relationships, the U.S.-China on one hand, the EU-China on the other hand, appeared to be heading in different directions. Do you agree with that?
I think the decision of the Europeans, of some Europeans, to join the bank is a pretty good, you know, example for how the Europeans completely pursue their own interests and often, you know, pursue them over the explicit wishes of the Americans who would like to do them, you know, like the Europeans to do it otherwise. I think the Europeans had two reasons in mind why they decided that they needed to be on that bank. The first one is that, of course, you know, that bank is meant to actually pour out money. You know, contracts, big infrastructure projects to companies that need to build them. The Europeans wanted a part of the cake, you know, a share of that sum, and that's a very very clear calculation. But also, they, you know, when they look at it as a geopolitical project, I think they clearly see that it's better to be part of the story and not be outside of it. You know, when you have voting rights inside. Then at least you can influence it somewhat, you know, as opposed to being outside and having no influence at all.
Well, and that's what we hear today. I mean, 57 member countries, and there's no one country that's necessarily going to decide the direction of the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. There are 57 countries. swarming around China as it puts this thing together. So that argument seems to be playing out.
I think the status gain of China, of course, is big.
Yeah.
Because it runs this, basically, it's the biggest player in it. Quite clearly, it's a big prestige issue for them. But I think in terms of having a say in a new development, I think the argument of the Europeans is not all that kind of, spineless as it sometimes seems to the Americans. I think it's proper realpolitik. It makes good sense.
Last question. The previous Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, seemed to really be focused on the Asia-Pacific, but this current Secretary of State, John Kerry, has dedicated extensive efforts on renewing the U.S. commitment to Europe. To some extent because of the crises in Syria and Ukraine. We have a presidential election ongoing in the United States, and we'll have a new president in January. What suggestions would you have for this incoming U.S. president with regard to U.S.-EU relations?
This is always the hardest part because, who am I to recommend anything to a U.S. president? But nevertheless, of course, being a think tanker, I have recommendations. I think I have two, basically. The first one is, if possible, to make this quadrupling of U.S. defense spending in Europe that was just announced a few months ago by President Obama as a reaction to the Ukraine crisis and the need for a robust response and the reassurance within the NATO framework, to make that a permanent feature. It's currently a special pot. This needs to be studied. It needs to be a reinvestment in Europe. We have seen for 25 years a systematic disinvestment of the United States from Europe, not only in terms of its military presence, but also in terms of the political capital that a president can spend on Europe. How much can you ask? How much can you get away with? And that needs to be at least partly, healed and rectified, I think, because Europe is eminently strategic. Mm-hmm. It is a strategic landscape. It's not a done deal. It is a very fragile continent. It needs the U.S. investment and the U.S. infusion of trust. So that's the big kind of, recommendation that I have. How to pull this off, that's for the newly elected president to figure out. The second thing
I'm not going to ask you to make a prediction on that.
I'm very thankful for that. And you don't have enough whiskey to, The second recommendation is something a lot more technical and small, but I think it makes a difference. If possible, the new U.S. president, when announcing the new ambassadors in Europe, should make professionals the new ambassadors, not give this, to donors and fundraisers, political appointees with no background in diplomacy, but give this to professionals, at least in the key 6 or 7 or 8 markets that matter in Europe. It is, of enormous, symbolism to have, real diplomats in those jobs again, and not this kind of, signal that you send by putting an actor or, a steel manufacturer in that job. Mm-hmm. Basically, what you're saying is you don't matter all that much anymore. And I think this is something that is actually something that's very cheap to have, but makes a big difference, and is a factor in the soft power that the U.S. has in Europe as well. So I'd recommend that very strongly.
Well, it's very, very, very interesting point, and you make a great ambassador for Carnegie Europe, and we're glad you're out here in China this week to talk China-EU. You're welcome back anytime, Jan. Thank you very much for joining us today on the China and the World podcast.
Thank you, Ambassador Henley.